Hello, everyone. Welcome to the keynote address of the new year, 2011. So we are doing the first keynote address of 2011. It's a new year already. I wish you all a very, very peaceful and productive 2011. And the technology that we are going to use, of course, is virtual. It's a virtual conference. We are going to have participants from Class A, B, and C. On behalf of Praxis, Manavi, and the Office on Violence Against Women, I welcome you again to this year's first keynote address. We are in for a treat today. Before we get to the speaker, let me summarize the role the program of keynote address plays in Advocacy Learning Center's curriculum. Some of you already know this, and you've been on a number of keynote calls. But just to remind you again, the keynote addresses have been designed as a part of the ALC to inspire our thinking and analysis and to sharpen our advocacy and to see how we can improve it, how we can be more sensitive to the needs of the women we work with. The keynotes are supposed to not only enlighten us, but it's there to challenge us to move beyond our routine understanding of violence against women, sexual assault, as well as domestic violence. And they are challenging to us to think out of the box, to strengthen our advocacy skills, and to find allies in most unlikely places, and to strategize how we can do that. Today, we have someone who is going to teach us or take us in that direction. We have Professor Holly McGuigan of New York University Law School to speak to us about a very important and controversial part of our advocacy for victimized women, women who are charged with crimes. When today's speaker, Holly, and I first met, and I learned that she is a defense attorney, I was a bit appalled. I hope I didn't show it.
You showed it.
But I was hoping that she didn't get it, but obviously she did. But I was like, oh, my God, how could this very smart, very knowledgeable and sensitive person defend batterers? How could this be? Or so I thought, really. And I'm so very glad that I did not run away from her. Over the years, Holly has taught me some very serious lessons about roles defense attorneys play in keeping women safe and bringing justice in the lives of the marginalized in society. She has literally changed me and shifted my thinking about advocacy profoundly. And today I'm so glad that you will have the opportunity to listen to her, to this amazing legal mind and a thinker. Of extraordinary proportions, I should say, and some of our thoughts about working with victims. I'm so very fortunate and privileged to present to you Professor Holly McGuigan. Holly?
Oh, thank you, Shamita. I remember when we first met, and actually I want to talk about four things today, but one of them is to pick up on your theme of how important it is to find allies even in the most unlikely places. But before I get there, the four things I'd like to talk about are these. The first is the history, from my perspective, of litigating defense claims on behalf of women who've been victimized by family violence, intimate partner violence, sexual assault, especially the cases that I've worked on and that I've consulted on, involving a defendant, a woman who's a defendant, charged with a crime against somebody with whom she has a history. The second thing is thinking again about women accused of crime, the extent to which the changes over the last three decades in terms of access to information and access to services has really made a difference to women accused of crime. And there I'm going to talk especially about women accused of killing, but I think those lessons affect women accused of all different kinds of crimes. Third, I want to talk about persistent misconceptions and offer some ideas about why they continue despite the changes that I hope to talk about a little bit in the second part. And how much worse they are when you get into a courtroom and the misconceptions about women who've been victimized by violence, those misconceptions are compounded by other misconceptions on the basis of her race or her ethnicity, her immigration status, her sexual orientation, her gender identity. I mean, all these things you all know better than I do what they are. But it does become a very difficult job to try to even identify all the wrong ideas she's got to cope with while she defends herself against a charge of crime. And then the fourth thing I'd like to do today is make a plea for slightly less hostility between advocates and criminal defense lawyers. I don't mean to eliminate all hostility. I mean, Shamita and I have eliminated most, but I don't think we've eliminated all hostility, but to try to overcome it. And I'll talk a little more about that later. But what I'd like to do, Shamita, if it's okay with you, I'll just tell a couple stories.
Please,
about
yes.
Early history. Is that all right?
Yeah, absolutely. Your stories are amazing. I love them.
Well, okay. Thank you. I'm going to focus on, for the purpose of these stories, a couple of cases that involve women who kill adult men in the context of intimate partner violence. That's the most common scenario that I've dealt with, although there are lots of others. And as Shamita knows, in the work we do together at the law school at New York University, we deal with a lot of same-sex couples as well as cross-sex couples, a lot of family violence, intergenerational, a lot of sexual violence in and outside families. So I'm going to focus on these just at the beginning, just to give a sense of some of the history for those of you who weren't around in the late 70s. In the late 70s, I started hearing about women's claims of self-defense and what was special about women who claimed self-defense. And there were some famous cases. There was Yvonne Wanro, there was Inez Garcia, there were cases who are known to people who are my generation. But what I didn't get at all, was why those self-defense claims were special. I'd been a public defender, I was in private practice. I thought I really understood self-defense claims, and I thought also, I was so wrong, but I thought as well as a white middle-class person could, I understood something about class bias and racial bias and animosity toward people accused of crime. Then I met a woman accused of killing her abusive boyfriend. I was assigned to represent her, and I met her shortly after her arrest, before even the preliminary hearing. This was in Pennsylvania, which has preliminary hearings. And the story she told me was that she'd been in a restaurant with her boyfriend, that he'd gotten drunk, that she told him he was too drunk to drive home, that he disagreed with her. They went out into the vestibule of the restaurant. She reached in his pocket to get the keys out to keep him from driving in that state, and he started to strangle her, and he was strangling her through the restaurant. Now, for those of you who've done this work, you know that strangulation is commonly used. I didn't even know that. So I hear the story about he's strangling her, and I think that's such a weird thing. And back to the restaurant, she tells a story about falling out of her shoes and knocking things off tables, and there were all these patrons there. And just finally getting to the back of the restaurant, she could hardly breathe. She was calling for help. Nobody helped her. She was at a serving table, and she picked up a sharp knife and stabbed him, and the knife went through his arm into his heart and killed him instantly. So I thought, wow, I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that nobody helped her. I just had no place to put that story. So I hired an investigator, and he went to the restaurant, and he insisted that I come that next day to the restaurant. And I said, I don't have to come. He said, you have to come. So I went. And at the restaurant, it was a neighborhood place. There were all the people, not everybody, but a lot of the people who'd been there the day before when it happened. And he said, tell her what you told me. And there were people looking at each other. And finally, a man, I don't know, in his 50s or 60s, who seemed to be the spokesperson, a white guy for this crowd, said, well, you know, we noticed that there was this black couple and they were having this fight. And I said, why didn't you help her? And he said, well, we feel really bad about it now, but at the time we assumed they were married. And I was appalled. And I realized I didn't know anything at all. It had not occurred to me that that would be a thing I'd had to think about, and that that would be a reason that somebody wouldn't help somebody. So I reached out for help, and I got it. The Women's Self-Defense Project at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York provided invaluable assistance. It was just amazing to work with them. And they told me something. They told me things that were hard for me to hear, frankly, about what kind of jury I'd want in a case like this. They said, you can't do away with racism. You have to think about how different people are going to react, and maybe you want some of your jurors to be older white guys, like the guy in the restaurant. I go, older white? No, come on, really, what are you talking about? And they said, no, frankly, I think they won't care so much that he died, and they'll be appalled that he beat her in public. And I thought, oh, I just don't. I was so appalled. So they said, here's what you have to do. You have to get the judge to ask the jurors a bunch of questions about their attitudes. So I said, he's not going to do that. They said, yeah, tell him we've found that it's necessary. I said, who found? They said, he won't ask. I said, indulge me. What if he asks? They said, well, say the National Jury Project. And then I said, and what have we found? They said, he won't ask. So, okay. So I go into court and I say to the judge, when you're questioning the potential jurors, when you're doing voir dire, please ask these questions. He said, okay, write them down. So I was completely unprepared. I had not for a second thought he would do it. He did write them down, and I was amazed as all these jurors I would have thought were great for me, independent women of all different races, all different ages, the kind of people I would think know how to stand up to authority, have made their way in life, have, within whatever range of choices they had, have made choices that were in favor of some level of independence. They all took themselves out, saying, no, 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 she'd have to convince me she had no option. So that was another eye-opener. And so I went back during the lunch break, and I called the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I said, you guys are geniuses. This is unbelievable. I never would have thought this. And I hear one of them say to the other, Cook, get on the phone. McGuigan got someone to do it. We can put it in the book. So they put it in the book. But more importantly from that, what I learned was that you have to reach for help every place in cases like this. I was willing to learn, but I had really no idea how much I needed to learn. And I say that a lot of that needing to learn is still to be found today and still to be found among lots of people, including defense lawyers. I think the main lesson from those early cases, this was in 78, 79, 80, and I did several cases, and I had the enormous good fortune to be in the town where Sue Ostoff was. At that time, she was with Women Against Abuse, so I learned an incredible amount, and I had a stunning amount of support from her. But the thing that I figured out was that the hard lesson was explaining to people there's no separate defense. The hard lesson was explaining this is a homicide like other homicides, or this is an assault like other assaults, but where the defendant is a woman with a history of, with the victim, it becomes much more complex and much more complicated. And I talked before about some of the biases. One of the things I'd like to say now is that I didn't pay enough attention, even after I figured out that people would be hostile, and increasingly so now against immigrants, that people would be hostile against poor women, hostile against women of color. I actually didn't realize the extent to which people would think, including often my clients, that they were to blame when something went horribly wrong in their family or in a friendship or in a relationship. And that hasn't changed. One of the first cases I worked on in Philadelphia, a woman was offered a plea that would have avoided the possibility for going to prison and would have meant she could stay with her then 5-year-old daughter. And she turned it down. She had to go to trial. And when I asked her why, it's obviously her choice, but when I asked her, she said, I need to know. I need someone to tell me whether I'm guilty. And 33 years later or something, just a case that Shamita and I worked on just last year, a client also turned down what seemed to be a very good plea offer in terms of minimizing her risk, because she and her children needed a judgment about whether what she had done was a crime or whether what she had done was justified and not a crime. So what's changed? I mean, you know...
Holly, can I just jump in and ask you a question?
Yeah, of course, yes.
Because something that you said was interesting.
Yeah.
And as advocates of battered women and women who have been sexually assaulted, we tend to think of women as the victim. And you use the term victim in terms of the person who was probably the abuser and had died.
Well, that's the way the courts do it. And
Shamita,
let's think about terminology, because you and I have differences when we work together on cases. The courts tend to think of the person who was the complainant in the case as the victim. We tend to think, and it complicates things, as women who are survivors of intimate partner violence or of sexual violence as the victims. So the term gets used two different ways. Maybe from now on I should talk about, in homicide cases, the decedent, and in assault cases, the complainant. Because when we're talking about women, women who are accused of crime are overwhelmingly women who've been victimized, often by the person that they're accused of committing a crime against, and almost always by somebody. I mean, women are victimized routinely.
I think it's challenging for us to think about it this way. I mean, when you said it, I kind of had to, you know, wrap my head around it. I said, oh, okay, that's what she means. So it's important for us to even hear it and get used to the idea. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And actually, that leads into something that I was going to talk about the changes over the last three plus decades now, and whether they've made a difference in the attitudes and the terminology, the attitudes that confront and the terminology we use to describe women when they're accused of crime. Like, for instance, and you, Shamita, know this better than anybody on the planet, probably. I mean, we've seen not a great effective increase in the numbers of shelters and service organizations, but certainly a huge step forward, huge. We've seen mandatory arrest, and I'll come back to that a bit about whether that's a step forward or not. We see specialized prosecution bureaus often combining domestic violence and sexual assault in a bureau that's called Special Victims. We've seen the change of rape shield laws so that women who are the victims of sexual assaults are no longer liable to be cross-examined in the same way they were when I first started practicing. There's a rise in advocacy organizations for victims, special courts in the criminal side, special felony, domestic violence, and sexual assault courts, integrated courts that are meant to be, you know, one judge, one family, so that women who are victimized don't have to go to family court and then to some civil court and then to a criminal court. There's like specific guarantees, certainly not in all parts of the country, but in my part and in other parts, that women who are victimized won't have their immigration status turned over to the authorities. So all these things are better, but I'm not sure mandatory arrest is better, but the other things are certainly better. There's lots more information from government offices and from NGOs. But when we look at what their impact is on women accused of crime, I just don't know that I feel that they've had a big effect there. Go ahead.
Yeah, Holly, before we go perhaps open up the lines for questions from participants, can you summarize just what are the impact? What is the impact of all of this? Or is there any impact at all? I mean, I know you're kind of skeptical about, from the tone I'm getting, you're a little bit skeptical, but what's the impact of all the changes?
You mean in terms of women accused of crime?
Yeah.
I think, one is that and everybody must have seen this. I'd be amazed if people haven't observed this. Many, many more women are now arrested for misdemeanor domestic violence than ever before. It's across the country in many jurisdictions, it's as many as a third, sometimes 40% of the arrests for misdemeanor DV are women. The misdemeanor arrests are the overwhelming majority of the domestic violence arrests in most jurisdictions, certainly true in most big cities. And not to say that the felonies aren't charges that have horrible implications, but the real spike that we see is in the numbers of women accused of misdemeanor domestic violence. And we know all the collateral consequences. I mean, the National Clearinghouse for the Defense of Battered Women has a wonderful fact sheet on collateral consequences that range from immigration to housing to custody of the kids to loss of employment to just endless and a horrible spreading cloud that goes out from being arrested for what might otherwise look like not such a big deal, misdemeanor. We know that there's an increase also in the felonies. It's not so remarkable because there hasn't been the same spike in the number of felony filings in cases involving women who are arrested in the context of domestic or sexual assault. Mandatory arrest is certainly a big part of the spike in women's arrest, despite the legislation, the common legislation across the country in various states of that mandates that the police officers make an assessment about who was the primary or predominant aggressor, that they make an assessment about self-defense. You know, you just relocate discretion.
Perhaps maybe this would be a good time also, you know, after you finish your thoughts on mandatory arrest, to open the lines up for some questions.
Absolutely. Yeah, let me just finish that quickly.
Yes, please.
I don't think that we've seen the result we expected with mandatory arrest. I don't think anybody expected or really planned. Some people certainly warned us that there would be more arrests of women. But I think people didn't expect that concomitant with mandatory arrest would be this spike in the numbers of women arrested. And I think also people didn't anticipate what's been found, which is that rigorous enforcement of orders of protection works differently in different parts of the country and with different groups of people. I mean, the numbers haven't been analyzed really very carefully, but to the extent there have been studies, it looks as if vigorous enforcement of protective orders across the board is more likely than not to help married white women, less likely to help unmarried black women, and actually is correlated with their being more vulnerable to an attack. So it's complicated. That's really what I'm saying, that you can't have a one-size-fits-all approach with law enforcement when you're meaning to cut back on or control or at least mitigate the level of violence directed against women in this country.
Mm-hmm. And the studies do show that it helps married white women more?
Yeah, more, it helps. The enforcement tends to help married white women and tends to hurt unmarried black women. Now, this was not an anecdotal study. This was just a numbers study off the Bureau of Justice Statistics numbers. So it clearly needs more evaluation. But the important thing, I think, from these early analyses is that you can't have just one cookie-cutter approach.
Great. So why don't we open up the lines for questions? You know, Holly, I wanted to ask you, I take this moment to ask you something about the impact of all of this on immigrant women.
All of this. It's, the impact varies region to region, but the impact is really shockingly awful for immigrant women. One, in one context, it's the situation arises when she's the complainant, when she's recognized by the criminal justice system, which you like to call the criminal legal system. She's where she's recognized as the victim, right? She's the person who's been injured. The problem, not so much in New York in some areas, but certainly in other areas, is that the federal funding to state and local police maximizes the likelihood that in some areas her calling 911 will lead to information about her status being turned over to ICE. That's one consideration. It is a certainty almost that information about her will be turned over if she's the one who's arrested. And bear in mind, we're talking about this increase in the numbers of arrests and the increase in the number of women specifically arrested for misdemeanors. So that's one thing. Another thing is that, and Shamita, you know this, that the certificates of cooperation are often sometimes withheld and sometimes surrounded with many conditions by prosecutors for women who would otherwise get a visa or a waiver or be in line to apply for one, so that women for whom pushing the arrest of a partner is not the best thing, they may find themselves from an immigration standpoint in almost as bad a situation as they would be if the police had exercised discretion to arrest them instead of the man. And then there are all the, I mean, every time an immigrant who has any problems with documentation comes in contact with a governmental system, she's at risk. And the problem with calling 911 is you can invoke lots and lots of systems without even realizing you're going to do it. And certainly if you get arrested, you are right in the middle of lots of systems. Does that help? Is that?
Yeah, it does. And it also makes me feel kind of pessimistic about it.
Yeah, well, it's terrible because, I mean, I do training sometimes with immigrants' rights groups here in New York, and it's very frightening. This is now switching to the calling 911 thing, because lots of advocates say to children, if anything's going on, call 911. They make a point of telling the children to call 911. And I'm not saying that's not the right thing to do. What I'm saying is people should be aware that, one, the police who come may well arrest her and not him, especially if his English is better than hers, he's been out and about and is, you know, seems more to the police like a person who's credible than she does.
Mm-hmm.
So she might get arrested, but even if she doesn't get arrested, she's hurled into these systems. So it's a scary, terrible situation with no one answer.
Mm-hmm.
I would be the last person to say not to call 911 in an emergency. But I think it's wrong not to be aware of the range of other consequences, especially for immigrants.
Yeah. It is hard to know where to go at that point.
Yeah.
Do we have any questions?
We do have a guest in the question queue, and that comes from the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. Your line is now open.
Hello, this is Eileen Hudon. And
hi.
My question is about expungement and other ways of helping women after they're out of the after they're out of jail or prison or
when the case is over.
Yes.
Well, it's always there are several. It's hard to answer that because it's such a state by state remedy. Expungement is usually available only when you've won the case, only when the case has been completely dismissed or when she's been found not guilty. Some states have provisions for expungement if it's a fairly low-level misdemeanor and she goes a certain amount of time without being arrested again. If she's found not guilty, the case is dismissed, expungement is an option every place and should be pursued. Another possibility is certificate of relief from collateral consequences. In New York, it's called relief from civil disabilities. And what that does is, even if she were convicted, there are certain collateral consequences under state law that a judge can order don't have to fall on her, like losing her right to vote for a while, like losing her right to be in public housing, that kind of thing. One of the things that I suggest for everybody is that if there is not a group in your area that's working on the rights of people who've been in the criminal justice system, especially those who've been convicted, who have much more complicated problems, you should talk to local law schools and see if they have a clinic that works on the rights of former prisoners or formerly convicted people. Sometimes they call it offender reentry, which is a terrible name, but it's the one that's gotten a lot of funding. So I do suggest, if you're interested in any kind of attempt to help a woman get rid of the collateral consequences of being arrested, whether she was convicted or not, you reach out to a law school clinic, because there's a lot of funding going now to what they call offender reentry.
Thank you.
Holly, again, before we go on to the next segment, one of the problems, following up on Eileen's question, one of the problems with immigrants is that anything means automatic deportation at this point, right? Any arrest?
No.
It doesn't. Okay.
No. Generally, there's a very complicated chart, but generally, if a person, first of all, you're not, an arrest by itself doesn't make you removable or deportable.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, the arrest often puts you at risk if there's some other reason for instigating or initiating removal or deportation actions against you, like illegal reentry, overstaying a visa, I mean, any of those documents issues. So even an arrest can trigger that. Involvement with the criminal justice system as a defendant will provide a basis for your removal or deportation if you're convicted of a violent felony and domestic violence is categorized as a mm-hmm. violent felony, or a crime of moral turpitude. So there is great risk there. That doesn't mean that people should give up, though, because there are increasing numbers of advocates for immigrants who are having success fighting even the removal actions, I mean, getting judges to exercise, immigration judges to exercise discretion, even in cases that look very bad. I say don't give up hope, but recognize it's really awful. It's really, mm-hmm. the consequences of conviction on a domestic violence case are very bad.
Okay. So if there is no more questions, perhaps we can go on to the next segment.
Okay.
Is there anyone? Any questions at this point?
At this time, there are no additional guests in the question queue.
Okay, thank you. Liz, shall we go to the next segment then?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, thanks. Holly?
Okay, well, one of the things that that I wanted to talk about a bit was homicides in comparison with other charges that might be charges related to homicide in comparison and contrast with other charges that battered women and women who are victimized by sexual assault might face. One of the things that people ask a lot is whether there's an impact on the numbers of homicides from the resources that have been made available in the last 30 years. That was the stuff I was talking about earlier about changes in legislation and special courts and stuff. I don't think anybody actually has a good answer to that question. I mean, what we know is that the gross numbers of homicides, I'm talking now about intimate partner violence because mm-hmm. that's what I've been following. The gross numbers have been on a kind of downward slide over the last 30 years, but recently people who pay attention to these things have noticed what they call a spike in the numbers of domestic violence, intimate partner violence, homicides. They often don't separate them out very carefully. But what we do know that's interesting, so we know that the numbers are not huge compared to the numbers of general assaults within the community that we're caring about. But we know that of the homicides, and this is where men are killed or where women are killed, something like 75%, and again it varies from region to region in the country, but 75, sometimes 80% of those cases show no prior contact with the police, nobody arrested in the couple or the family. They're just outside that whole criminal legal system. And people don't know why, and it might be because of people know about the collateral consequences of arrest, immigration, for instance, in the way we were just talking about Shemitah. Maybe in some areas it's because they're afraid of racialized or racist treatment. Maybe it's because the social services that are around that are aimed at providing help actually are. Maybe it's because they know that the social services that are available are all too often aimed at separating them, and sometimes that's just not what she wants. So I don't think we can see a real correlation between the increase in resources devoted to domestic violence and sexual assault and a diminution in the numbers of homicides, at least in the DV area. But that said, it's important to keep a sense of scale. Like, my particular interest has been for many years in women who kill, but it's important to bear in mind that those cases are only in the hundreds in this country. Now, that's too many. I mean, no death that could be avoided should ever happen, but we know that 1 1/3, 1.5 million minimum women are attacked every year by family members. That's not even counting the sex assault attacks. And the filings, we know, in all cases are some tiny portion of that, and overwhelmingly, as I said before, they're misdemeanors. The homicides are really, as I said, in the hundreds, and it's, I think the focus, it's useful to look at the killings, and it's useful to look at women accused of killing and what happens to them, but not because it's anything like in the numeric incidents that other assaults are, but because it gives us a good window into the misconceptions and the attitudes about domestic violence that we still have to confront. Should I talk a little about those?
Yeah, please.
Well, I think the misconceptions fall into two main categories. One is about the circumstances of the killings, and the other is about the nature of the defense that a woman uses. The first, about the circumstances. If you ask people, if you say, for instance, a battered woman is accused of killing, people will overwhelmingly tell you that they assume that the man was sleeping or distracted or was incapacitated in some way or had his back turned or she hired somebody else to do it. I mean, those are the cases that get the press. You know, you hear about them a lot. But what we actually know, and this is, I've studied this in the context of homicide cases, but I'm convinced that it's true for the much larger numbers of misdemeanor assaults and felony assaults, that if you look at the cases carefully, in the homicide context, between 70 and 90% of the cases involve what we call confrontations. That means there are facts that could get to the jury on the question of self-defense. They might be disputed. That's not the point that I'm trying to make. What I'm trying to say is they're not sleeping man cases. They're not contract killing cases. They're not cases where he's drunk out of his mind and incapable of moving. They're cases where the decedent behaved in a way that the defendant, the man in the cross-sex couple instance that I started out with today, behaved in a way that she interpreted as posing an imminent threat of death or serious bodily injury. That's the first thing. He behaved in a way that she interpreted in that way, that she was reasonable in making that judgment, that she was not the initial aggressor, she didn't start it, that if there was a duty to retreat in that particular state, she didn't violate it, and that the force she used was proportional. Now, the law doesn't require that the force she used be the same. The law recognizes, because the law evolved in the context of self-defense cases involving men who knew each other, the law recognizes that differences in size and age and capacity could mean that if you threaten me with your fist, I'm not going to be able to repel that attack unless I use a weapon other than my fist. But the picture we have is of her as a kind of vigilante. And that picture, which is so stark in the press and in lots of TV movies and in lots of other movies, is one that carries over and creates difficulties for our clients when they're accused of lower level, lower than homicide, even felony assault or misdemeanor. So one thing that it's really important to try to get people to recognize is that overwhelmingly when women use force, they do so in a circumstance that would look to an outsider like self-defense. Now, we might debate it, as I said. The facts might be disputed, but they're not these caricature cases of a woman who's just acting like she's taking the law into her own hands. It's a phrase that people like to use.
If I may interject.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Okay.
You know, a number of cases of South Asian women who have kill their abusers. One of the things that I've found is in some of them are during sleep, when the man falls asleep. But he probably said, you know, I'm going to sleep. He was drunk and he went to bed and said that when I wake up, I'm going to kill you and your kids. But
right.
He was asleep. I mean,
Yes. I'm not saying that those cases shouldn't be defended and shouldn't be seen. Very often they are self-defense cases, especially the example you use is one I think that everybody who does this work has heard that story and from all different kinds of people. That what he does is he threatens, I'm going to go to sleep now and wake up, I'm going to take this gun and shoot the baby in the head, I'm going to take this knife and I'm going to slit your throat, so that from her point of view, the danger is in fact imminent, even if right at this moment he's not confronting her, because as soon as he wakes up or as soon as he regains capacity, he will. Those are harder cases than the ones I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. The point I was trying to make is that although those cases are hard cases and they are deserving of every bit of energy we can put into them, they're not the classic cases, not for South Asian immigrants, not for other immigrants, not for people born here. Those are just not the classic cases. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not that it's not hard, those cases. No. But it's also not that they're not winnable. It's that I think what happens is we get this stereotype and then we don't look at the individual facts of the case.
Right.
And that's what I'm trying to argue against.
Yeah. No, I get that. But I was trying to say that for the woman, there is this imminent danger.
Yes. And I don't think there's anybody who doesn't know of cases that have been tried successfully on that theory, especially where he threatens to do something as soon as he wakes up, especially where she is held hostage in some way, sometimes not physically, but often emotionally by threats against her family, if her parents, for instance, have also come to this country and are accessible to him, or even if they're back home and his family could go after them. Do you see what I mean? I think there are ways that we can help finders of fact, jurors or judges, understand the imminence of the danger and the reason she couldn't get out from under, like, why didn't she just leave when he fell asleep, right? That's the question they always ask. I think we can explain that. But what I was trying to say is I really hope that what we can do is start looking at each case on its own. There certainly are common themes, and there are things we want to draw on the collective wisdom of people who've worked on them. But we don't want to have, like, one case that we think is the archetype.
Mm-hmm. Sorry if I distracted you.
No, you didn't. No. Actually, can I talk about the bad thing that legal training does?
Absolutely.
In this regard? First-year students, or whatever year in law school they take criminal law, they read the case of Judy Norman. It's a case from North Carolina. Some of the people on the call may have heard of it. It's a case that was one of hideous abuse, just unbelievable abuse. Over a long time. It's painful to read these facts. And she killed him while he slept. And there was a self-defense claim. It was not successful, but ultimately, that part is not so important. Not successful at the trial level, which is why it's on appeal, which is why we can read these horrible facts. It's a terrible case. It's a hard case. And it's appealing to law teachers precisely because it's right at the margins, because as a moral matter, it seems that what she did was absolutely justified as a legal matter. It's a push to fit her into classic-looking self-defense. Not impossible, but it's a push. But we teach that case to our law students and we leave it alone as if that were all battered women's cases, all of them. At the same time, we teach a case called Regina versus Dudley and Stevens, which is a very old case, Regina, right? It was an old English case, where some guys are shipwrecked, and they're starving, and they draw lots to see which of them should be killed and eaten by the others. And there's no question that one of them is going to have to be eaten by the others. They would die otherwise. There's also no question that the guy who pulled the short straw was probably going to die anyway. Now, this is a horrible case, also a hard case in many ways, like the Judy Norman case. But nobody teaches Regina versus Dudley and Stevens as an example of the ordinary perils of maritime travel. I mean, they just don't do that. But they teach Judy Norman in a way that makes people think their clients, one, have to measure up to Judy Norman in terms of the horrible history of abuse, and two, reinforcing the idea that most of the cases happen with sleeping men. So I think the lawyers have a lot to answer for in perpetuating this stereotype. Do you want to hear about another one the lawyers have a lot to answer for?
Yeah.
Yeah, do you?
Yeah.
Well, that's the notion that there's this separate battered women's defense.
Yeah.
Or a separate battered woman's syndrome defense.
Uh-huh.
And that when women kill or assault or are accused of assaulting, they're going to claim that they got to do it because he had beaten her in the past. It's just not true. That's not the defense. Usually what she claims is self-defense. Sometimes she claims insanity. Sometimes she claims duress. Sometimes she claims necessity. These are all classic, traditional criminal law defenses. They've been in existence for as long as there have been courts in the system that were either in England or in countries that were colonized by England. I mean, it's those defenses all exist. And as I said earlier, the law of self-defense was evolved through the years in a situation where, throughout history as now, the vast majority of alleged assaults and alleged murders happen between people who are family members or known to each other or at the very least acquaintances, but the majority of them are in the same family or are actually known to each other. And so since the law has developed in a way that takes into account differences between people in terms of strength and size and past threats and past violence, the defenses that battered women offer when they're accused of crime are classic defenses. They're self-defense, sometimes, as I said, insanity, sometimes extreme emotional distress. The labels don't matter so much as the notion that there's not a separate defense. It's not a freestanding extra defense. Now, there's a question also about using the term battered woman syndrome, which probably the listeners know better than I, has implications. Battered woman syndrome sounds like pathology. Modern experts talk much more about battering and its effects. They don't talk so much about syndrome. I have to warn you that lawyers are reluctant to change. I remember a meeting in 1987 or 1988 that Sue Ostoff organized in Philadelphia. By this time, she was running the National Clearinghouse for the Defense of Battered Women. And it was a meeting with some lawyers and some experts and advocates. And the advocates were saying that battered women syndrome as a term had to be replaced because their clients were facing this stigmatization that they were unwilling to put themselves in that box, that it didn't help them understand their own experience, that it didn't help them navigate the repercussions of having been arrested, and that we just couldn't use that term for expert testimony anymore. We were at that point probably 10 years into having convinced judges, having started to convince judges to let us offer expert testimony on why a woman would stay, about what the effects of violence would be on her sense of danger, about why the history mattered in a particular way, all those things. And I remember at that meeting feeling panic at the idea that we should give up the notion of battered woman syndrome. And I was one of the people who said it just terrifies me. We finally got judges to agree to it. We finally taught them that they should let us offer this testimony when it's appropriate, when we think it'll help. And now we've got to change it. We did, of course, have to change it. I mean, the advocates were right. The experts agreed with the advocates. It was really the lawyers who resisted. And I think it's important, I mean, to start thinking about the fourth thing I said I wanted to talk about our working together more, that is criminal defense lawyers and advocates.
Before you go there and go
yeah.
to that fourth point, Holly,
yeah.
Maybe we can just dwell on this a little bit and then we can go on. Because one of the things that I think comes up for many of us who are advocates and the way we have been funded and where our money comes from and for what reason, you know, it basically comes for us to provide advocacy and work with victims, right? Quote unquote victims.
Yep.
And we think of victims as these, you know, for a better word to say, pure victims. Whatever that might mean.
Yep, we do.
Yeah.
Yep. Have you ever met one?
I'm sorry?
Have you ever met a pure victim?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It becomes very hard for us to include victims who kind of hit back or stand up or let alone commit a crime. Unless she has been coerced by her abusive partner to sell drugs or some of those kinds of things, that she kind of stands up and does something, even if it is in self-defense, it still is she's taken an action that will be equated to crime in society, right? It gets labeled as that. So it's always very hard for us to work with, work in that kind of a shady area. It's as advocates, we would much rather work in this pure victim region, or our money gets targeted to work with quote-unquote pure victims. And it becomes really difficult, and I don't know how to negotiate, and I cannot blame advocates or think about my own advocacy in how I can go there. But I know that you as an attorney, you work in that shady area and in that controversial area. How would you think we do that? How would you think we go there?
Well, you know the funding issues much better than I do. But I think in terms of analysis and how you think about who's a victim, you realize that somebody who's accused of crime is only accused of crime. And that, I was about to say for one hysterical moment, can we indulge the presumption of innocence? but it's actually true. And you know the way people talk about the presumption of innocence? They say presumed innocent until proven guilty.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the right formulation at all. Presumed innocent unless proven guilty. Not until. It's not a slippery slope. The arrest doesn't mean necessarily she's going to be convicted. It simply means she's been accused. So I think one thing is just to think in that way about the fact that if she says she acted in self-defense, then what she's saying to you is it's not a crime. She was that's a justification, not a crime. If she says she was in a fugue state, she doesn't remember what happened, she lost it, she went crazy, that could be insanity, not so much in many jurisdictions. I know that it's changed since John Hinckley, but it could certainly be extreme emotional disturbance. That's a mitigation. That means she's not culpable, at least not culpable at the level that she's been charged. So I think that one of the things that's important is to go back to actually, Shami, to the question you raised early on in this conversation, is what do we mean by victim? And I think if we stick with the idea that a victim is somebody who's been harmed by a family member or somebody else in the course of domestic violence or sexual assault, she's the victim. She may also be the accused, but she's presumed to be innocent. And the other thing that I really want to urge upon you is that your expertise is essential if she's going to get a fair trial, because most lawyers out there don't have any idea how complicated this is. Most lawyers out there, even lawyers with a lot of experience, are exactly where I was in 1978. I mean, they may mean well, they want to work hard, but they just don't get it, and they rely on stereotypes, and it's busting the stereotypes. That's one of the great things that advocacy organizations can do. And how many, what do you think, Shamita, for how many of the people on the call, maybe they can answer, have clients who have been arrested? I mean, you don't dump a client just because she gets arrested, right?
Well, no, of course not. But why don't you open up the line?
There are advocacy organizations in New York that used to.
Mm-hmm.
That used to.
Yeah, I know that some of our funding agencies have kind of come back to us and said that that's not what we do. That's not what we want you to do.
Yeah, and I can't help with that. I don't know about funding, mm-hmm. but I do know that that critics of some of the agencies in New York, and this is a problem 30 years ago, and it's a problem now in New York, that some of the agencies just drop clients if they get arrested. Critics say she's already your client. This is like she got evicted. I mean, this is clearly serious and horrible, but you don't get to just let her go. And maybe, I mean, some groups have gotten around it by having some separate little piece of funding for the difficult, not pure victim clients, but I don't know that stuff. I mean, I just know that from what I hear from colleagues here in New York. But what I want to urge is that people figure out, to the extent they can, how to stay on cases where their ongoing clients are arrested. That seems minimal to me, that you can't just dump somebody.
Right.
And the other is how to be helpful when battered women are accused, and
right.
figure out if there's some way to provide at least some assistance. And certainly at a minimum, the lawyer should be told by the advocates to call the National Clearinghouse for the Defense of Battered Women and to be told that they'll help them find experts, that they'll help them find people who can help them understand the case. And I know if you're not getting paid for it and you're an overworked community-based organization or NGO, I'm asking a lot, but I think it's life-threatening for advocates not to get involved more in this. I mean, it's easy for me to say because I've had the great good luck of working with the National Clearinghouse in SUO and now with Steps to End Family Violence here in New York. So my criminal work has always been with the support of advocates. And I know that tradition doesn't exist other places, but
mm-hmm.
I really beg people to reconsider their feeling that their hands are tied by funding considerations when the numbers of women arrested, as I said before, in misdemeanor cases are going up and up and up, and a lot of those women are going to be doing life on the installment plan if we don't intervene early.
Why don't we open up the lines right now and ask people the question that you're asking? So this time you get to ask everyone a question.
Okay, first we do have Seeds of Hope. Your line is open.
Thank you. This is Robert Tyson, Seeds of Hope here in Waterloo, Iowa, in Grundy Center. And I certainly don't have a question, but I just want to bring up the fact that the word that we keep mentioning is that imminent danger is that we look at with women and was force necessary in their protection. And I
mm-hmm.
guess as advocates and law enforcement and judges, we look at, you know, especially police officers, who's committing the most harm, who's the most aggressive, who has a history of violence, and was self-defense necessary in those situations? I can't really relate back to the women that some of those videos, the movies like Clint Eastwood, and the woman goes around killing four or five men who abused her and her sister. But again, that whole imminent danger issue is one of the keys. And, of course, with prosecution, again, it's difficult sometimes when you don't get both parties to certainly cooperate with law enforcement. And with that whole mandatory arrest, dual arrest rate, we did a study here the last 4 years here in Blackhawk County in Waterloo, and we found out that 83% of the men have been arrested for domestic violence and only 17% of the women. And so that kind of changed our perspective there. But from what I do with the Iowa Accountability Program, that 17% of those women, I certainly want to know what percentage that is of African-American women or people of color. Is that percentage way out of line compared to our general population? So we're going to be doing some studies on that in this upcoming year. So I just wanted to point those things out. But again, the key for everything, I think, is there fairness for women in those situations? So I'll stop.
It'll be wonderful to hear the results of your study, because I think if you go into any courtroom, if you go into any criminal courtroom, you'll see a disproportionate number of people of color. And I would be very interested to know what you find out about that 17%. Because my gut feeling is that it's probably not a fair representation of the population of that county or the state, whatever the area is.
Yeah, I agree with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there another one?
At this time, there are no additional guests in the question queue.
I know, Holly, you wanted to ask everyone a question about working with women who have been charged with crimes.
Yes, but I don't think anybody responded.
Well, let me ask. Is there anyone who here who has some experience of working with women charged with crimes?
Okay, we do have Rave. Your line is open.
Hi, I just wanted to comment a little bit because we've seen a real increase of our clients who have been arrested for domestic violence. But when we get them into the counseling session and find out the true nature of what happened, it sounds like the police are kind of turning against the victims. And the clients that we see, they're trying to protect themselves. It was in self-defense. And just with one case, one of my clients was being held and choked, and the only way she could get off or she could get him off is when she had to take a bottle and hit him over the head. Well, because he had a cut,
right,
he was arrested. But had she not done that, he probably would have killed her.
Yep.
So the problem is that the police are like, oh, well, we found some sort of crack in, you know, the law here, and I'm going to arrest the victims because she left a mark on him. And so it's kind of, it angers me that these true victims are being processed as the perpetrators. And so when we have someone call us and say that they have a charge of domestic violence, we'll do an intake with them to find out what the real story is, because 95% to 99% of the time, the women that come through here who have been arrested, it was in self-defense.
Yep. Thank you for that. I think that's really true, and it echoes what Robert, the previous caller, said about the dual arrest. And I think what's happened with the pro-arrest stance and of almost every jurisdiction and the mandatory arrest stance of a huge majority of them is that the police who have anti-victim, anti-woman, anti-survivor attitudes get to indulge them, either by arresting her instead of him in the example you gave, or by arresting both of them, which is, of course, a total catastrophe if their children then are taken off by children's services. It's a very difficult thing, the increase in the numbers of women arrested, and the story you tell about the 95% of what you hear is consistent with what we see too, that women are arrested when they tell a story of self-defense that if a man told it would be taken much more seriously. If a man told it and the other person was a friend, when men in same-sex couples talk about self-defense in the context of domestic violence, they have as hard a time as women.
But these are the places where you do some vigorous advocacy, even when you don't, with institutions, wouldn't you say, Holly?
Oh, yeah. And I think, Praxis Knows actually almost literally wrote the book on working with law enforcement to do training and to help them understand the frontline officers who are doing the response to the DV calls. But I'm skeptical about how, I mean, I think that's very important to do, don't get me wrong. I think that's key, and that is an important role for advocates to play. But I'm not confident that that's going to solve the problem. I think it'll help. I think it'll help a lot. But I think as long as there are police officers with these anti-woman, racist, anti-immigrant, anti-gay people, I mean, whatever their prejudices are, the mandatory arrest schema lets them indulge them.
Well, thank you for that question. That's really a very important question. Anyone else?
Yes, we do have Seeds of Hope. Your line is open.
Yes, I have a question. My name's Barb from Blackhawk County in Iowa.
Hi.
Could you speak about, I had a case where the woman in self-defense stabbed him in the chest. He didn't die, but they had to meet the five rules for self-defense, and one of them that she didn't meet was that her weapon was of more damage than his. She had a knife, and he only was hitting her with his hat, but his physical size was bigger, and he was drunk, and she had prior knowledge of his violence, right? So she was scared, but she didn't meet all five of those because of that. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think generally one of the criteria for self-defense is that the force is proportional. And so on the basis of what you've told me, assuming there's a difference in size and a history of violence, I would disagree with the judgment that apparently was made in that case, that she didn't, that they apparently thought, was it the DA or the jury? I don't know what stage you were at.
In the jury, yes.
The jury thought that she had used disproportionate force. And it's heartbreaking because you know that it's ridiculous, that the question is not, the question is whether she's reasonable to think she needs to pick up a knife to protect herself from his attack. And one of the things the jurors should be reminded is they get to think about his earlier attacks on her as they assess her reasonableness. And she doesn't have to be correct. The law doesn't require that she be right. The law requires that she was reasonable. And the criteria usually are that the harm he posed was imminent, as the earlier caller mentioned, that she didn't start it, she was not the initial aggressor, that she didn't violate any duty to retreat, that she was reasonable in her belief, and that the force was proportionate. That, and so I disagree with their judgment, and I'm sorry that it happened. It's, but I think it happens routinely, I'm sorry to say, all across the country, that when women use weapons against men whose weapons are not knives and guns, but their fists or other implements, the women have a hard time making the case that they use proportionate force.
Yeah, and her defense attorney was not happy with her decision to go to trial. He wanted her to plea bargain because he didn't believe that she could make all those five criteria.
Yeah.
And so I think in his mind going in, he didn't defend it.
Mm-hmm. Which is a big problem. I mean, right, when lawyers, it's weird. So when I first started doing this, lawyers wanted their clients to plead in cases like this all the time. It was very hard to get them to try a case. Then there was this long time that everybody wanted to do one of these trials because they were seen as zippy and fun, and you'd get. And now I think lawyers are just not exercising the right kind of judgment. And the decision, as you noted, is hers, whether she goes to trial or not. And it's the job of the lawyer to get on board with that. You don't get to hold back just because it's not the decision you wish she'd made. You have to go for it.
Mm-hmm. Do you have advice about how to work with an attorney like that in a different way?
Yes. I think one thing that's very helpful is to figure out something the lawyer might actually read to give him a sense of background. And the National Clearinghouse for the Defense of Battered Women, which is, you know, part of the Battered Women's Justice Project, has a lot of materials. I think it also makes sense to not, I'm talking about something to he'll actually read, not to shower him with stuff, but something straightforward and relatively easy. I think also offering to help him develop the case, because very often advocates are much better at asking questions about the history of abuse between them and at understanding what it means to her. And sometimes just helping the lawyer understand that can make all the difference between his commitment to putting on a case and finding witnesses who will help a jury say not and guilty in the same sentence. It really is about motivating and educating them. It's not about giving them a whole lot of material all at once until they're ready, because they'll just put it aside. Trust me, they'll just put it aside. But saying, I can be helpful. I know her. I know this stuff. I know how to ask questions. Let me help. And you need to obviously figure out about roles, because you don't want to be in a position where your involvement upsets the integrity of his claim of attorney-client privilege. But I've done a lot of work on that, and so has the National Clearinghouse. So I think the technical stuff that lawyers might object, you can just say, people have dealt with this, we can figure this out. But I think the best thing is to say, let us help.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question. If there is nothing at this time, is there anything?
There are no additional guests in the question queue.
Thank you. Then perhaps, Holly, you can go on to, we're coming close to the end of the session.
Yes. Oh, actually, the only other thing
so
I wanted
to... wrap up, perhaps?
Oh, go ahead. What?
Go ahead. Just to wrap up. Oh, yes.
What I wanted to do was talk about our experience working together, Shamita, who said very kind things, but I wanted to share with people some of what our students observe.
Okay.
There are times when Shamita and I are in class together, and She'll be talking about how annoying lawyers are, about the kinds of questions they ask. And Shamita used last year as one example, who cares if he hit her with a closed fist or an open fist? And I raised my hand. Because lawyers care about that stuff. And it's hard for us to recognize that it's not always the question that has to be asked first, that it's not always the technical things we need that need to be front and center. And I think that working with you, Shamita, has helped me understand much better about how to ask questions, how to actually listen, how to hear, how to not be so linear and so, boop, 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 let me ask my questions. But the final thing I wanted to say was that you and I think you should correct me if I'm wrong, Shamita, but I think you and I think we've overcome a lot of differences, right?
Yep.
And we've come a long distance in understanding each other.
I think so.
And that we get along and we really agree on just about everything that matters.
Yep.
And then the students at the end will tell us one of the great things about the seminar was how wildly divergent our opinions were about everything, how they found the differences between us to be so wonderful. And I think it's interesting that our experience of it, working as a defense lawyer and an advocate together, is that we've come very close. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that to other people, we really do approach these questions very differently, and we can enrich each other and learn from each other. But we do approach them differently, and that's a strength, that we can actually watch and learn different things from each other's way of approaching. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, of course. And I think one of the things that you wanted to discuss today at the end is how we can how we can collaborate with defense attorneys. And that,
yes,
I think, is the lesson that I always take from you.
Yeah. I think that there are various ways. I think it's different in different places. I know that in Seattle, the King County Domestic Awareness Project, Domestic Violence Awareness Project, I can't remember what they were called, I'm sorry, and the Public Defenders the Domestic Violence Project got a grant to work together with the Public Defenders, and they did a two-day training, and there was a lot of hostility there, but my sense was that people learned a lot from each other. I think another thing is whenever there's an individual case, to try to educate that lawyer about the sorts of things he or she doesn't understand about the history between the parties. And the National Clearinghouse is willing to help anybody who's working on these issues all the time. I mean, they do extraordinary work in this area. And I think that we just have to keep trying and recognize that until we get more successful than we are, women who are accused of crime are going to be blamed for not leaving, blamed for not escaping if they actually wanted to leave, certainly blamed for not leaving if they didn't want to leave. People hold that against women so much. They're going to get blamed for all their visible characteristics that are different from the fact finders. And we're not going to make very much progress unless we work together. And I think we can start to open people's eyes about a lot of the stereotype thinking that goes on. And one aspect is joint trainings and trying to bridge the gap, just starting to talk about trusting each other and sharing some basic information. And another is case by case. And my sense is that they're both important and they both have a role, but very often the human contact over months and sometimes years that advocates and lawyers form when they're working on a case for a client makes a huge difference. And that lawyer then educates other lawyers about the importance of working with advocates. Now, I know that sometimes it's not fun to work with lawyers, but I hope people will try. People do hate lawyers. I understand people don't like working with lawyers, but it's really important.
Shamita?
Uh-huh. Yes?
This is Amanda.
Oh, hi, Amanda.
Hi, how are you doing? I just thought I'd come in with a question. My
yes,
star
please.
One wasn't
Go
working
ahead.
For some reason. I'm not sure why.
Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Holly. Hi, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm good.
Good. Okay, so I have a couple of questions for you. One is, like, in this, I'm going back a little bit to the self-defense discussion, but in terms of, like, a movement-wide kind of you know, where we should be going with this. It doesn't it sound like there's some reason, basically, to actually examine current self-defense laws and the way they're written, because as with many laws, they weren't written with women's experience in mind. So that's my first question, and if that's been attempted or thought through or whatever. And then in relation to that, like, the mandatory arrest laws were obviously an attempt to, you know, by the movement to change legislation to make it so that the systems kind of address this issue differently. And it does make the system address this issue very differently than what it was before. That it used to be the arrest rate in domestic violence cases was like, you know, 3 or 4%. And that was usually the 3 or 4% of guys who hit the cop. So, while he went out there. So that's made a drastic difference. But then, you know, sort of another layer on top of that has been the predominant aggressor laws. So that's the other thing. I wondered if you would speak to that and how that's another kind of attempt to change things to make this system work for these particular kinds of cases and what's more relevant to women's experience. So I just wonder if you can
sure.
talk to
yeah.
those two things.
I think in terms of the, let me do the second one first. I think that in any state that where there's mandatory arrest legislation, where people haven't looked at the good work that's been done in some states to make it clear that the officer who responds to the 911 call is meant to do an assessment for who was the primary aggressor, and if you can get it through, do an assessment for self-defense. The first is easier, I think, to convince legislators to do. The second is harder, but it's gotten through, for instance, in New York and almost every place where Mark Wynn has endorsed it. People have tried, at least, to get that through their legislatures. And that's key, because when the language was primary aggressor, as you know, in Minnesota, the officers were interpreting that if she did anything, if she even tapped him on the shoulder to get his attention, she was the primary aggressor. So changing it to predominant is key. And I think a self-defense assessment is also key. But that said, I'm skeptical about the utility of mandatory arrest laws. That train has left the station. I'm not calling for a change. But I am calling for people to be critical and thoughtful, because what we've learned now is that a reform that was meant to benefit the victims of domestic violence actually, in many, too many cases, leads to their being victimized again by being arrested. So it's thinking through carefully the significance of legal change and what can be accomplished by simply changing the words in a statute. And that leads me to your second question, which was about changing the self-defense standards. And I have thought about that. I've been thinking about it for 30 years. And my conclusion, time after time, is that we should not change the self-defense standards. And it's for reasons that are not unrelated to what I said about the behavior of police officers. If you set up a special standard, then judges will find a way to keep women out of the benefit of that standard. And we've seen it in many states that have enacted special battered women's self-defense laws, where the judges refuse to apply them to women where there's a contested history of abuse, where she says there was abuse, but there's a conflict about that. I think judges will try to exclude women, and this includes women judges. Judges will try to exclude people, especially women, from the operation of special statutes that are meant to protect people accused of crime. So my sense is the better strategy is to try to get judges to apply the law and to recognize that, and I don't mean to dismiss the significance of the truly hard self-defense cases, the ones that don't look like a confrontation, but in some ways I think our focus has to be first on the vast majority of women accused of crime who would be okay under regular self-defense law and who would maybe be disadvantaged under special standards if they didn't fit them, and just get the judges to apply the law. I mean, if we could get there, if we could get, like in the case that the earlier caller mentioned, get a good instruction on proportionate force doesn't mean the same force, and you have to consider the history when you think about the reasonableness of her picking up a knife, we're going to do better. And that's actually, frankly, where I would start, not with changing. I would actually work with language on the mandatory arrest standard with the skepticism I mentioned before, but I'd be very reluctant to change the standards of self-defense in a way that seemed specific to battered women, because I think they'd be excluded from its operation. That's just what I've seen in the efforts so far for reform along those lines.
Yeah.
I know.
Interesting discussion.
I'm sorry.
Well, no, I just wonder that, you know, it's about, in a sense, we're still operating within the existing paradigm, which we have to do, but it just seems that the very basic idea that what it is that years of abuse does to someone, that there must be a way for the law to take that into consideration, and right now it doesn't.
Right now it doesn't enough, but it could if we tried the cases better. I mean, the thing is, the law was developed, as I said before, not for these one-off, one-time encounters between strangers. I mean, that's the picture we have sometimes, but actually the law was developed to recognize that old men got attacked by young bullies in the neighborhood, that sick men got attacked by healthy young men. I mean, the law actually takes into account, as it's written in every state, a history between the parties, a difference of size and strength, the reasonableness of a knowledge that, of a an actor's knowledge that danger is facing when somebody else might not see it. What we need to do is translate those standards so that the judges understand that they apply to women who kill or injure in the context of family violence. And I know it's very frustrating and it's very hard, but it's, I think a better strategy, but I share your frustration that it's very hard to get prosecutors, judges, and jurors to understand the significance of a history of violence. It's very hard.
Amanda, it also scares me when you say that what years of abuse does to women. It scares me because not all groups or all women have the same effect. And I am always afraid that when we have that kind of standard set out, then people, women who don't fall within that get, you know, treated in some different ways or badly or, you know, in some problematic ways. So we have to keep thinking about that.
I think you're right, Shamita.
Okay, thank you.
We are really coming to an end, and what we have done today is listen to the in some very intriguing ways of understanding our work with women and advocating for women. And Holly, you have reminded us and challenged us to think differently. And I think you've reminded us that advocacy for victims includes vigorous advocacy for abused women charged with crimes. And I think that is so, so very important to keep in mind. And doing our work well and efficiently, that's important. And thank you so much, Holly, for being there. And is there a last word you want to say to the participants?
No, just thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you to the callers for the comments. I appreciated them very much.
And thank you. I really enjoyed listening to you. I want to thank all of you for joining us on this keynote address. The Praxis and Manavi staff is always available to you for any questions and support. Stay very well. I'm kind of afraid. I just came back from India, and I'm looking outside at all the white stuff, and it scares me a little. So keep thinking of spring. You know, collective thinking might get it here sooner. Thank you again for joining us today. Goodbye.
Thanks. Bye.